There are many older adults who remember their teen years fondly and still would not wish to be a teenager again. All the hormones, all the angst, living under parental rules when the parents are boring, living under societal rules that seem to change by the minute. Yeah, being a teen can be tough. Perhaps a degree tougher for American teens who are also Muslim. Can you imagine? Our guest this hour took it out of the realm of imagination by showing us what it's like for male teenagers to be American and Muslim at the same time. John O'Brien is the author of the book Keeping It Halal, The Everyday Lives of Muslim American Teenage Boys. John is an assistant professor of sociology at New York University's Abu Dhabi branch. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for joining us today. You point out right at the top, and it's a good disclaimer, this is not about ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Why did you feel the need to say so?
Well, two things, really. One is that I think a lot of people who don't know much about Islam or Muslims just immediately associate anything about the religion with violence. A lot of surveys show that people do that because they don't have a lot of good information about it. But also because when you really get to know regular Muslim people, you see that these groups really have pretty much nothing to do with their daily lives for the most part.
So let's talk. I mean, they have some solid numbers here at the beginning. How many Muslim Americans are there, and what tiny percentage is linked to any plots?
Yeah, so, I mean, Muslims are really less than 1% of the population of the U.S., which is part of what makes it complicated, that most people in America don't actually know Muslims themselves. So what you get is kind of messages through the media, news coverage of violent events in other countries or these isolated incidents. And so you don't have a lot of kind of everyday experience with a neighbor or a friend who might be a Muslim person to kind of counter that stereotype. So I think that's one of the issues and why I think it's important to get these kind of stories out where people can have a sense of what Muslim people are actually like.
There's an interesting reference in here to young Muslim Americans as unmarked. Is that sociology speak?
It is. Particularly young Muslims who are just kind of going about their daily lives. I think, again, the things that kind of attract sort of media attention on a lot of the major, you know, cable networks and newspapers can be kind of incidents of violence. But then what you don't see, there's not a sort of article about, you know, Muslim kid goes to school or Muslim kid plays basketball with his friends. So we don't really see kind of this everyday regular life, which you'd see of people of any religion or any background. So you kind of miss that part of the story.
So it links back to what you were just saying, where most of us don't know any Muslim Americans, and the stuff we do know tends to be stuff that's not great.
That's right. That's right. And it's just sort of part of, I think, a lot of different factors about a lot of these terrorist organizations really like gaining media attention. That's the kind of thing that terrorism tries to do, is gain media attention. And then a lot of media, mainstream media outlets, you know, like to show violent things because they keep people watching the news. So it can be sort of a tough thing to break out of.
So what you've done here, this is not a coast-to-coast kind of survey. Tell us about your approach in Keeping It Halal.
Yeah, so this is a kind of method that we call ethnography, where you spend a long time with a small group of people. It took me about 3.5 years of time with this group to really dig into their lives, get to know them well, and then kind of write the book after that. So it really is just digging deeply on one group of friends who I got to know very well by going to the mosque where they attended and getting to know them. And I think it just gives sort of a texture of really what their daily life is like. So you don't get the kind of breadth of a large survey. There are some studies like that, but I really wanted to get a sense of kind of the human scale and what their lives are all about.
So were you trying to deliberately pretty much mirror the arc of their time in high school, that 3.5 years?
Yeah, I think it didn't actually, start off that way. As many projects do, it kind of unfolded as it went. But I sort of got into this mosque. So one important part of the story is I'm actually a Muslim convert myself. So I was raised Catholic and always felt pretty religious, pretty spiritual, but my parents sort of didn't really keep practicing that much, and I kind of learned about different religions as I got older and met some friends who are Muslim and learned about the religion. And then in 2003, I actually became Muslim myself. And so that kind of gave me a window into the lives of Muslim Americans who I got to know, and then really seeing how little a lot of non-Muslims knew about Muslims in the U.S. So when I went to grad school for sociology, I sort of started doing this project and decided I would do it, try to get into this mosque as a place to kind of investigate the social lives of Muslims. And then I just really fell in with this one group of young men who happened to be in this kind of adolescent period, which ended up being very fruitful because it is a time, as you mentioned at the top of the show, that there's a lot of challenges. Many of us, you know, it's a time of really identity exploration, figuring out who you are, what are you about. People kind of try on different identities in a way. And that's really what was happening with these kids, except there was one of the identities was Muslim and the religious identity of being a Muslim person.
You chose being Muslim, though, yourself, and I'm just curious about the timeline there again, because you mentioned converting in 2003, so this is after 9/11, and I wonder if that was a complicating factor at all for you.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It wasn't really complicating because, you know, if people who are Muslim themselves kind of feel very little connection to these kind of terrorist attacks, and I mean, it can affect people's lives if they're discriminated against, of course, after the fact. But, you know, 1/5 of the world's population is Muslim, and very, very few of these people have any kind of sympathy for groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or things like that. So, yeah, it wasn't really related in a sense, but it was definitely dramatic that it was happening around that time. I was learning about the religion before 9/11, actually, through the woman that I eventually married, who was Muslim and who I learned a lot about the religion from. But it was definitely interesting timing, and to be sort of part of that community when all these dramatic things are happening in the world was definitely an intense time.
No doubt. So when you went to volunteer for the Muslim Youth Program, and you only identify this as a major American city, you call it Coast City, did you plan to study these guys? Was this all, I mean, was this the final goal in the beginning, or did you just want to go and work with them?
I did want to do some kind of study, so it was going to be a research project, and I met the leader, religious leader of the mosque, and introduced myself, and they seemed quite interested in this. I mean, one thing about this mosque, and many mosques actually since 9/11, is that they're quite interested in getting attention of outsiders. So they were quite helpful in hooking me up with meeting these young people and getting more involved in the community in general.
All right, and so we get to know the young men through the efforts of John O'Brien. His book is called Keeping It Halal, The Everyday Lives of Muslim American Teenage Boys. We'll come back on the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with John. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John O'Brien, an assistant professor of sociology at New York University in Abu Dhabi. He's written a book about the 3.5 years he spent with young Muslim men in an American city. The book is called Keeping It Halal, The Everyday Lives of Muslim American Teenage Boys. You can join our conversation on the Exchange about this interesting conjunction of being teenage and American and Muslim all at the same time. Our phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the name for this group of young men, Legends with a Z, keeps coming up. What does that refer to, John?
Yeah, so that was sort of these guys had a sort of informal rap group that they like to be a part of. They like to write songs. They like to listen to hip-hop music. And I think it was, as I say, more maybe sort of in their imagination than in reality, but they had a sense of being kind of a gang, kind of a group of kids that hung out together. So they use that term for themselves, and especially when they're performing music for their friends and other people.
When you say gang, you don't mean in the gang sense, then the criminal sense.
I don't. More like a clique, yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right, just want to be clear on that one. You in more sociology speak, you write that they offered a rich cache of ethnographic data. Like what?
Just a lot of time hanging out together. I mean, it's funny. Ethnography is a method of sociology, but it's also very informal in the sense that you're really just spending time with people and seeing what their daily life is like. And so I really kind of remembered, you know, my own teen years just hanging out with friends, joking around, talking, you know, telling stories and helping each other kind of figure out different challenges. But for these guys, a lot of these challenges were really about this question of kind of how to be a good Muslim, which mattered a lot to them and their families, and how to be an American teenager. Of course, they wouldn't talk about it in these sociological terms at all, but I realized a lot of their kind of joking around and hanging out and playing music and things like this was really trying to figure out how to do this.
There must be a real trick to ethnography, I'm thinking, in the sense of, I mean, you're hanging with these guys who are not really your cohort, but they got to trust you a lot over time. But, I mean, I just wonder if there's concern about the ethnographer having an effect on the people being observed.
Yeah, no, definitely. This is a major concern of ethnography, and that's why it takes a lot of time to kind of win trust over people and sort of win rapport. And I think one way it works is it's kind of if you're there long enough, this is why these things take such a long time, that if people compare it to kind of having a camera when you're filming a documentary film, that eventually people actually sort of forget the camera's there. And so these guys knew I was doing this. They were open to it. Their parents, were okay with it. But I think I just hung out with them long enough that they kind of don't think about it, and they're just sort of doing their regular thing. And I do think I was able to build trust with them. I think they would sort of test me at the beginning and see if I was trying to get them in trouble or, report them to to their parents. They would kind of test me with different things. But I think over time they saw that's not what I was about. And I think eventually they did kind of relax and just sort of act as they normally would.
It is a book about young men. Why not young men and young women?
Yeah, well, there's a couple reasons for that. One is, in general, I think as an older man, it's harder to get in and click with younger women in a social way, especially in this kind of community where there are some gender norms around, what's appropriate for young women and young men. I think in this community isn't necessarily very strict in terms of gender segregation. There are some Muslim communities where men and women go to different parts of the mosque. They don't really sort of mix in the religious and community setting. At this mosque, they did kind of mingle a little bit more. But even so, I think it was just harder for me to relate to the young women. And so I didn't want to kind of present their story in a surface way that I didn't kind of have the depth that I got from the young men.
So is this a particular branch of Islam that we're talking about here? I mean, you mentioned that this community in particular is a little more liberal and a little more mingling goes on. But, I mean, I just wonder if this represents a mainstream of Islam or a particularly Americanized branch of it or what?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there haven't been too many studies kind of to, take stock of all the different kinds of Islam within the U.S., although people are starting to work on that. It wasn't really a particular branch. People are probably familiar with kind of Sunni Islam versus Shia Islam. Most Muslims in the U.S. are Sunni. And, of course, you have a mix of real ethnicities within Muslims in the U.S., people coming from many different countries, from the Middle East, from Africa, from Southeast Asia. And of course, there's many African-American Muslims. This mosque in particular was very ethnically diverse, which made it a little bit unusual. And it also didn't really kind of emphasize a certain sect, for example, Shia versus Sunni. So I do think it was a mosque that was a little bit unusual, maybe in the sense that it was very much trying to kind of form an American Muslim identity. But the more I got to know other mosques sort of in the region and other places in the U.S., I think a lot of mosques and young people are struggling with some version of the problems that I catalog in the book.
John O'Brien's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Keeping It Halal, The Everyday Lives of Muslim American Teenage Boys. And you mentioned, this is a great phrase, they live culturally contested lives because they are simultaneously in part of two cultures that do see some tensions. How aware generally are they of the tensions, or were they at the beginning of it when you said what you were there to do?
Yeah, I don't know that they're sort of consciously aware. I think they definitely know that there's challenges they face. There were certain things that I think they thought about and talked about more consciously than others. I think other things they just kind of worked their way through without really thinking about it. I mean, one thing that I talk about a lot in the book is this issue of dating, which is an issue not just with Muslims, but sometimes with different immigrant young people, different young people in conservative religious communities, where the expectations of what your religion or your tradition says that you should do in terms of dating before marriage and what you might want to do or what your friends at school are doing can be in conflict. And so this is something they definitely kind of thought a lot about, talked a lot about. Talk about trust. It took me about 2 years of knowing them before they would talk about this at all. So this is a very sensitive topic for them because there was really no guidance on kind of how to solve this problem. And so they would sort of try different ways to do it. They would try, some of them would try to date in a way that seemed very religiously appropriate, where they would say to each other, we're not going to kiss, we're not going to touch each other, we're not going to do anything like that. We're going to do this. This is actually where the phrase keeping it halal comes from. They would call this kind of dating keeping it halal dating. And then, but other kids would do more things kind of, hiding things from their parents and trying to like cross the boundaries a little bit there. But even those kids would try to kind of involve some kind of, appropriateness in the dating and meeting the, parents of their partner and things like that. So it was really, you really saw them trying to kind of work this stuff out.
And how much time, if any, did you spend with the parents getting to know their feelings about it too?
Yeah, I spent some time with the parents. I mean, I think, as I was saying earlier, it was important for me to make sure I had the perspective of the young people was kind of the focus of the book. So I feel like if I spent too much time with the parents, the young people would kind of see me maybe as allied with them and maybe not kind of open up to me. But I did get to know the parents fairly well. I think they trusted me. I mean, it almost became a point of tension in some ways, where I think the parents thought I was kind of a chaperone who was trying to keep tabs on everybody, but I had to make clear that that wasn't really my role. But I think the parents and the kids, for the most part, had a kind of friendly relationship in trying to figure this stuff out. Of course, there's moments of tension and conflict, as there always are with, or there usually are with adolescents and their parents. But I think for the most part, there was an openness on the part of these parents that I think was crucial to making this work out for the young people. That they weren't overly strict, they weren't overly harsh, they weren't overly kind of punitive. And I think they also knew that these kids were trying to work their way into a kind of Muslim American identity that would work for them.
I only talked about Muslim and Americans so far. Now, what about any cliques and groups within school, within the neighborhood, stuff like that? I mean, were there further subgroups that these guys belonged to?
Yeah, there were. I mean, there were different kind of subcultures, I think. Definitely, I talk about music a lot in the book. I think, different kind of activities that really pull kids together was important for these guys to kind of cross boundaries. So even though they had a lot of Muslim friends at the mosque, other things they were into, like skateboarding or basketball or rap music, was a great way of connecting them to non-Muslim kids at school, to kids of other ethnic backgrounds at school in the neighborhood. And so that kind of thing was really useful for them to gain friends. So I think there were some other kind of overlapping identities, but those were mostly about kind of, activities and sports and music and stuff. Nothing really along kind of ethnic or any of the lines like that.
Now, what about other subgroups based on where families come from and how many generations they've been there? Did you find some divisions like that?
Not that much. In fact, that was sort of surprising, and many people were asking me about that. It's, I think, a little bit, again, unusual maybe for this mosque, although the more I hear, I think more mosques are becoming like this now, is that there are some mosques that are more kind of ethnically singular, so it'll be a Bangladeshi mosque or a Pakistani mosque. This mosque was actually quite ethnically diverse, and I think they found a lot of pride in that, and this is one way they were trying to kind of manifest this American Muslim identity, is finding a lot of kind of ethnic pluralism and diversity within Islam. And that is one tradition that is there in the sort of texts of Islam and in the history of Islam, is that many people from many different backgrounds have been Muslims. And so that's a way I think that Islam actually kind of is similar to something about the U.S., which is a real kind of racial ethnic diversity.
John O'Brien's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's an assistant professor of sociology at New York University in Abu Dhabi. He's written a book about American Muslims in their teen years, where he just spent 3.5 years hanging out with a group of guys at the local mosque. The book is called Keeping It Halal, The Everyday Lives of Muslim American Teenage Boys. You're welcome to join the conversation with your own questions and observations here on the Jefferson Exchange. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. John, there's a question you include a couple of times. How are you an athlete, a math nerd, a rapper, a gangster, and an imam? Wow. Who asked it, and what was the answer?
Yeah, so this is basically one of those moments where I kind of saw what you were asking before, is were they aware of these different kind of identities and different sort of things they were negotiating? And this is the two sort of closest friends in the group, one kid named Muhammad and one kid named Yusuf. And it was just a moment of kind of, I think, awareness, or maybe not even very conscious awareness, but just hanging out in the mosque together and sort of joking around. And Muhammad saying to him, how do you be all these different things at once? And Yusuf was a kid who was interesting. He was quite religious. I mean, as with all people, these guys varied in kind of how practicing they were. Did they say all their prayers? Did they do everything right? And Yusuf was somebody who they nicknamed the Imam. Imam is a sort of Muslim version of priest. So he wasn't really an imam, but he kind of was called that because he was more of the religious. In fact, they would joke that, if you got in trouble, you should say you were with Yusuf, because he would always, he was the kid everyone saw as a good kid.
The stamp of approval from Yusuf, yeah.
Exactly. He was the go-to. But sort of that was, I thought, an interesting comment, because it really showed how, all kids of this age are trying to balance different things. Your identity at school, at home, in some kind of community, maybe in a church, maybe you're in plays at school. So what are all the different things? And all of us are doing this in some way. How are we a parent and someone at the office and someone who plays sports, et cetera? But young people, it's especially intensive. And I think part of the point of the book is to show that you know, this is just another version of that. And it's a version that has Islam as part of it, but it's not that different from a lot of young people and the different identities they're balancing, especially young people who might have some kind of home culture that has a tie to, you know, another country that their parents came from or a religion that their parents practiced and they've inherited or something like that.
You know, I realized I haven't been asking enough questions about the activities at the mosque for youth, because people who are not Muslim might not understand, but people who are not terribly religious might not understand either about how often they were there, what kinds of programs were offered for them at the youth group at the mosque.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And that's another way that this place kind of really took on an American character. And it's funny, when people would come and even visit, people from my school, my graduate program who weren't Muslim would come in and see this. They'd say, oh, this is just like a community center. It's, you know, they would have a soup kitchen. They would have sort of a Sunday school equivalent. They would have, you know, Quran classes, which would be sort of equal to like a Bible study. So I think in a lot of ways, mosques are taking on kind of elements of what we would think of as that a church or a synagogue would have. And one example of that is, you know, in Muslim countries, the real day of worship is Friday, which is a day off of work, and they have sort of the congregational prayer on that day. But in the U.S., they also have it on Friday, but the real main day of sort of community gathering and these kind of classes and activities is on Sunday. And so these kids really got to know each other at kind of the equivalent of Sunday school at this mosque, and it just became a place for them to return to, and they knew each other, and they knew, you know, other friends and other parents who'd been around there for years, and so it was just sort of a nice communal feel to it.
We mentioned that the young men, Yusuf, Muhammad, Ali, Abdul, and Fawad, also were part of a sort of loose rap group, The Legends, with a Z, but they actually did do some studio recording work, and it sounds like this expanded their social circle just a bit.
Definitely, yeah. They're very, you know, hip-hop has been shown in many other kind of projects and just anecdotal evidence that it really can bridge kids of different backgrounds. It has such a such an attraction to so many young people, which is why it's sort of one of the most popular music forms in the world. And so at the community level, it really is a way to kind of cross boundaries, especially because something that the kids were always excited about was that many American rappers are either Muslim, African-American Muslims themselves, or have a knowledge of Islam because there's such a history of Islam within the African-American community in the U.S. So they love to listen to rap songs and try to find, often there's kind of mentions of Islamic religion or something in Arabic or some kind of hint of Islamic culture in a lot of very popular rap songs. And so they would love to listen to songs and try to find these little kind of clues and point them out to each other and talk about, you know, is this rapper really Muslim or not? And so it was a kind of point of pride about that.
John O'Brien's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Keeping It Halal, The Everyday Lives of Muslim American Teenage Boys. You refer in the section of the book where they're listening to and taking part in rap to something called Islamic listening. What does that mean?
Yeah, so this is something I noticed, and again, this is kind of how this method of ethnography works, is that you spend enough time with people, and over time you kind of see these patterns and how they behave and things they do that at first you didn't really catch it, but over time you see they do it over and over. And so it was a kind of way that they would listen, because, of course, the challenge here with hip-hop music, and there's versions of this with different kinds of, I think, conservative religious young people, is that the music they really are drawn to often has profane language, references to sexuality, references to drugs and alcohol, things that are not halal by any stretch. And so, but they still want to be part of this music and listen to it. And so I sort of call this Islamic listening, because it was a way they would try to listen to this music, but kind of either edit it on the fly, turn the part of the song down when a bad word comes on, make up their own version of the song that sort of subs in more Islamically appropriate language for the very inappropriate language of the original version of the song. And so what I noticed about it is it was kind of was a way that they could both feel cool by being part of this music, but also feel like they were being Islamically appropriate. But I think also part of it was that it was just very fun. It was just like a fun activity they could do together. And so I noticed that was something they often did.
So fun in the sense of kind of getting away with something? I mean, is it on that line? Like, well, we're still Islamic, but we're also going to be listening to our music.
Yeah, I think fun in the getting away thing, but also just fun in the doing, fun in the kind of the creativity that it takes to kind of do this kind of joking around. There's a lot of wordplay. I mean, this is part of what people love about hip-hop music who like it, is that there's so much about wordplay and language. And I think these kids were very funny and liked to kind of tease and joke and play around with language. And so even that kind of rewriting a hip-hop song to be more Islamically appropriate allows you to both kind of, right, show that you know this song and you're getting away with a little bit of something by knowing it, but also that you're just sort of having fun in the process of even doing this. And so that was what I realized so much, is how much time when people spend together when they're young, they just have time to sort of joke around and talk and play these kind of games together. And I think that was really what made them feel comfortable and in who they were.
So how do they avoid the tag of being too religious? And I wonder, in a wider sense, if they got that rep in their school.
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. In their school, they didn't so much, I think, because they tended to kind of be a little bit low-key about their identity at school. They wouldn't hide the fact that they were Muslim, but they wouldn't necessarily advertise it or, you know, dress in a way that would necessarily signify that. And that's one thing I should point out about these kids in particular. Because they're young men, they didn't wear the headscarf. And, you know, a lot of women there didn't wear the headscarf. But so they were a little bit sort of understated about their identity at school. But one way they avoided trying to be too religious is what we just talked about, which is kind of referencing this kind of music that would show that they were cool. And, you know, they weren't totally, you know, out of the know of hip music, basically.
Much more to learn about being Muslim, American, and teenager all at the same time from John O'Brien's book, Keeping It Halal, The Everyday Lives of Muslim American Teenage Boys. Welcome back to the discussion with John, and you're welcome to join us by phone or email when we return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is John O'Brien, an assistant professor of sociology at New York University in Abu Dhabi, himself a convert to Islam about 14 years ago. And he made his work in the field about American Islam, American Muslims, rather, hanging out at the Muslim youth group at a mosque in a big city, and came up with a book about five young men called Keeping It Halal, The Everyday Lives of Muslim American Teenage Boys. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore the tensions of being American teenage and Muslim all at the same time. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned that they don't deny being Muslim in school. You did mention that some of the girls don't wear headscarves, that sort of thing. But otherwise, I mean, how observant are they? Are they praying five times a day and otherwise keeping up with the requirements of Islam?
Yeah, they really were for the most part. I mean, when I spent time with them, they were, I think, you know, they don't do everything perfectly, but I think they were definitely on the more kind of practicing side of the scale. And of course, it's all relative. There's always people who are going to be a little more like that or a little less like that. But I think, yeah, compared to other young people, they are pretty religious. And I think that was something that you mentioned before. It could be a kind of source of tension if other people saw it not, you know, not very cool to be very religious. They would have to kind of either downplay that or maybe sort of prove that they had some kind of street credentials with knowing rap music and things like that. So I think that was a big part of like the balancing act they had to do, was sort of balance against this fear of being seen as too religious or this fear of being seen as just sort of too different, too strange. People just aren't familiar with Islam very much to know kind of what it's really about. So I think they were often trying to connect with young people in these more kind of acceptable ways, like I said before, sports or music and things like that.
So, I mean, did it get to the point of them hearing a lot that, like, well, you're Muslim, but you're still cool?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I think one of the ways around that is actually spending a lot of time with each other. So I think this kind of spending time with a kind of Muslim-only friendship group is in some ways a defensive move to kind of make sure that you're accepting of one another. But even as they did that, they were kind of bringing a lot of American culture into their own group. So it was a way of kind of feeling like they were adapting to what was around them, but also maintaining who they were. But I think also they did spread out over time. I got to see them really get to know kinds of kids from other backgrounds who did sort of then learn about the religion through them and become more accepting of it themselves, and then even spread that word to other people. So I think that's a lot of how these things become more understood and accepted, is just kind of getting to know people and spreading the word and just having an open mind.
There's a fair number of requirements in Islam, as we just mentioned, but and I've had to call teenagers to dinner and found that they often didn't respond to that. So, I mean, what kinds of responses did these guys occasionally give to the call to prayer if it got in the way of things they were already doing?
Yeah, so that was something else I noticed sort of over time, one of these kind of pattern behaviors the call to prayer is something that really can pull against the sense of a teenager's sense of identity and really independence, right? So a lot of what your teen years are about is trying out kind of your own independence against your parents' kind of rules and things like that. And the rules of Islam could sometimes feel like they were pulling against this sense of freedom and independence and doing what you want when you want to do it. And so, I would notice that when the call to prayer would happen, which is something that happens 5 times a day, but in the afternoon when a lot of people are at the mosque, it's very visible. Everyone's supposed to come at the same time. And these guys would definitely have a more kind of slow, take their time, play around, chat with each other. But what was interesting is they always eventually got there. And so it was more like, we're going to get there on our own time and in our own way, which is a very classically teenage move.
It's our idea.
But they still kind of meeting the requirements. So I think that was what's interesting, is that it wasn't a running away from the religion. It wasn't a, diving in and being very strict on it. It was kind of a doing it with their own style, which made them feel like, okay, we're doing this and we believe in this, but we're going to do it in our own way.
So there is a caricature that they refer to sometimes, the extreme Muslim. Talk about how they created this caricature and how they react to it.
Yeah, so this is something else that I noticed of some kind of joking around and sort of teasing each other. And they would often have this kind of figure of the extreme Muslim, which is like this overly serious, very religious, very strict kind of voice that they would put on. And when they would sort of be, chiding each other for doing something the wrong way. But it was always in a very jokey way that wasn't very serious. I mean, even if it was something that they thought the other person should do differently, like, not listen to music out loud in the mosque or not dance in the mosque listening to your headphones, but they would kind of put on this voice, like no dancing in the mosque, to kind of joke with each other, but let each other know that, okay, we're not being this serious, right? When people do imitations, one thing they're doing is saying, well, we're not actually like that. And so I think it was a way of sort of keeping each other in check, but not, basically saying we're not like adults who do this. And I should mention, there weren't really adults in the mosque who were even that strict anyway. It was just a way of kind of saying, okay, we can be Muslim, but we can also be kind of, not overly serious about it.
It's interesting that effort to maintain the code of the culture and yet at the same time mock it a bit.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think there's a way to kind of take some of the seriousness out of it. I think one of the challenges with religion and with particularly how Islam is portrayed, because even these young people, there's no kind of hiding from the stereotypes of Islam. There's no, staying away from the images of what people think it's like and what it's about. And part of that image isn't just about violence and terrorism, but it's about kind of overly strictness, overly seriousness. And I think what strikes many people when they meet Muslims is how funny many of them are, how, there's a lot of joking around that happens. There's a lot of kind of just regular kind of everyday, language and talk that goes on. And I think that was part of their way of kind of reminding each other, that we can do this without falling into this kind of mold that many other people do.
Let us take a call here. We have Don in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John O'Brien, the author of Keeping It Halal.
Hi there. I wonder, were all the kids' parents immigrants from other countries? And if not, or if some of the kids had parents that either converted, from other religions, or they were American-born, or were born as Muslims, but it was the next generation. And if the latter, did you notice any difference in the kids?
Mm-hmm. And they're here instead of religion, for example?
Yeah, or their attitudes, or, were some kids more Americanized than others, and was that based on who their parents were?
All right, based on generations and that sort of thing. Thanks for that, Don. Appreciate it. John?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, these kids definitely were all their parents were immigrants. These kids usually came to the U.S. when they were very young. So they were what sociologists call the 1.5 generation, which means they're sort of between, they came when they were little. So they pretty much have been grown up in the U.S., but their parents had come from elsewhere. And I think really what made the difference in what you're asking, which is kind of what was different about how the kids were raised, is more just different parents' approach to it. So I did see some difference. You know, some parents were just more strict than others. In fact, one of the parents that was one of the most strict was actually a convert from within the U.S. But it really did make a difference. And, of course, even within one family, you could have one parent that's more strict than the other. So I think it seemed to depend a lot on just the individual parent's approach. But I didn't notice any pattern necessarily with kind of immigrants versus other kinds of parents on that. But that's a great question.
We have an email from Larry in Arcata, who it might be a little broad for your purposes, but he asks how Sunni and Shiite Muslims get along in the United States.
No, that's a great question. They seem to get along pretty well. Like I said, there's some different mosques where there's divisions over how they practice, but there's actually been a real attempt in the U.S. to bring Sunni and Shia Muslims together, especially when you're hearing about some conflicts in other parts of the world. I've been following a lot of groups, sort of community groups in the U.S. of Muslims who really want to make sure that those kind of divisions don't really happen in the U.S. So I think people are trying very hard to keep those communities getting along pretty well, and they seem to be doing that right now.
We did touch on the whole issue of dating a while back, which is you're not supposed to date, and you basically get married and then you begin to have relations with the opposite sex. Is that the general run of things in Islam?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it varies in different places, and I'm really careful in the book to say that this is kind of the version of Islam that was sort of practiced and taught at this mosque, which has, you know, various, you know, strands where it comes from. But yeah, in this case, and in many cases, it is kind of a more formal process of, you know, meeting someone, and maybe your parents sort of teach each, you know, get to know each other, and then they eventually become friends and eventually are married. But that was the expectation that was put on the kids. The challenge, of course, is that that wasn't really what was happening in the high schools or with many of their friends. And so it was really difficult to kind of follow those rules to a T. I mean, I think many of them tried to do it in some ways. Others kind of, you know, sort of pushed the boundaries a little bit. But there was an expectation that it would be, you know, something a little bit more formal. I mean, it's sort of an irony because on the other hand, they do want their kids to marry other Muslims. And so they're going to this Muslim youth group where they're meeting other Muslims who they maybe hope they will marry at some point. On the other hand, they don't want them to date. So it's a little bit of a conundrum in that way.
This is where they tease each other with stuff with the extreme Muslims, like you have to be 16 inches apart. I mean, what are some of the rules that they're supposed to be observing?
Yeah, so it's funny because I think that was one way that this mosque really tried to kind of differentiate itself from other mosques and from kind of stereotypes of Islam. I think gender, as we're learning even in American culture writ large now, is such a contentious issue in so many ways, and within religions in particular it can be very tricky. And so it's a real dividing line, I think, among Muslims is how you look at gender issues. I mean, there is a lot of people that argue that, you know, there should be these strict guidelines about men and women should not be mixing and they should be segregated in different parts of the world. There are Muslims who follow those guidelines, but there are many others who don't. And I think it's just one interpretation that can sometimes get a lot of attention that is more strict. But in fact, this mosque and many other places don't really agree with that. And they don't really find that the Quran and other sources of Islam say that you need to do these things. So when they're making those jokes, they're really making fun of people who they think are overly strict and who worry about these ridiculous things like, yeah, exactly how far apart do a man and a woman stand, and getting kind of hung up on the details of rules. I think that's one thing that people in this mosque, including these young people, thought was really a shame, that a lot of people who say they're speaking for Islam are getting hung up on these tiny rules instead of the bigger picture, like how do you treat other people and, you know, what do you believe and how do you feel about the world and things like that.
American teens in our time seem to hug fairly frequently within and across genders. But is this, I mean, obviously forbidden between genders. What about among the young men themselves?
Yeah, no, that was definitely an issue that came up, and it was interesting because I think what was so great about this site that I sort of stumbled on is that there was a place where they could have these conversations with adults. So things like, you know, hugging people and dating, I mean, they would talk about these issues with adults who were trying to think through this with them. So it didn't feel like it was sort of a conflict or an opposition. It felt like it was a process that people were trying to work out together and how to figure out how to do this and maintain this culture and religion that they cared about. And so hugging was something that really came up, and basically the religious leader said, you know, I hug people when I see them. I think this is okay to do. This is part of American culture. But the emphasis was, but your mind has to be in the right place. So this is the challenge of how do you guarantee that and how do you do that? But I think, again, it's the emphasis really on kind of having the intention. There's a lot of emphasis in Islam on having good intentions in what you're doing. And if you have that, then that's the important thing.
And you write about some of the specific young men. Yusuf, in particular, had a girl that he clearly cared for. They did keep it halal. They kept it. They kept themselves apart. It was a very difficult thing, and ended up ending it. For others in the group, though, it sounds like keeping it halal became a very broad term.
That's right. That's right. So this is something else that I noticed, and it's not unusual for this to happen, I think, in religion and other contexts, that language can be very kind of elastic and stretchy and can have lots of meanings within it. So what counts as halal was a little bit vague, I think kind of intentionally. So the more specific you got about, okay, like Yusuf, as you said, and his girlfriend said, okay, we're not going to kiss, we're not going to hug. They made these very specific rules, which I think was very kind of had a very good intention behind it. But it's very, very hard to do that in an American context as a young person with your own kind of hormones and your own, you know, desires and seeing what your friends are doing. So that was very hard, I think, in a way, because they set up such strict kind of rules for themselves that it felt like they were just basically failing if they ever even thought about anything that went around that. Whereas for the young people who are a little bit less strict on it, a little bit less serious about it, and treated it as a little more broad, they didn't feel so bad. They kind of could live with this. And again, it didn't mean they were still following a lot of the rules. They were still, you know, introducing their, you know, partners to their parents and things like that, still being appropriate in some ways, but not just basically, I guess, being so hard on themselves. I think the problem with a very strict approach to religion with young people is that it just brings more tension onto them and more kind of stress onto them. And so the challenge is, how do you find a way to allow them to have that identity without bringing that kind of stress and tension to their life?
It sounds like ultimately for you, this was a fairly joyful experience. I mean, and not a short one, 3.5 years you spent with these guys.
No, it was fun. I think if it wasn't, it would have been hard to stick with it for so long. But I think I learned a lot. I think it was, in the end, a very positive and kind of hopeful experience about, you know, it's really part of the story of America that people come from various places and find ways to kind of combine their own backgrounds and traditions with American society, which I think is a great story and one that I hope will continue.
And it's well told in the book Keeping It Halal, The Everyday Lives of Muslim American Teenage Boys. It's the work of John O'Brien at New York University in Abu Dhabi. John, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. I had a great time.